From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're following Hurricane Matthew, which has actually gained steam, nothing in its way as it heads to Florida. Governor Rick Scott says people in its path should have a plan or leave now. We'll get an update.
But first, let's bring in our NPR political team to digest last night's vice presidential debate between Senator Tim Kaine and Governor Mike Pence. Joining us is NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
And White House correspondent Tamara Keith is with us as well. Hi, Tamara.
Hello.
And let's start with your initial thoughts. A lot of the polls that have come out have shown an edge to Pence in the debate last night. But Domenico, what did you think? What did the candidates do well and not so well?
Well, you know, I thought that obviously, you know, Tim Kaine stylistically came off looking a little overeager. He had one job last night, and that was to attack Donald Trump, not even Mike Pence, to sort of make Mike Pence have to answer for Donald Trump. And Mike Pence didn't really do that. I mean, to me, this debate sort of felt like, you know, two dads at a backyard barbecue who like won't stop talking about politics. And you're sort of like gets awkward and you're like just wish they'd go back to the kids. But then you just wind up leaving them alone.
Tamara, your thoughts? Two dads at a backyard barbecue or something else?
I'll let Domenico just have that one. I think that Pence was cool and calm. It was a major contrast from his running mate, who in the debate last week took all of the bait that Hillary Clinton laid out. Well, in this case, Mike Pence really didn't take the bait from Tim Kaine. Tim Kaine and the Clinton campaign, however, did get what they were after, which was Mike Pence repeatedly denying that Donald Trump said things that Donald Trump had actually said at some point in the campaign.
Well, one of the things that came up was the foundations, the Trump Foundation and the Clinton Foundation. Both nominees bashed the other's running mate on this. Here's Pence talking about the Clinton Foundation.
The Clintons figured out a way to create a foundation where foreign governments and foreign donors could donate millions of dollars. And then we found, thanks to the good work of the Associated Press, that more than half of her private meetings when she was Secretary of State were given to major donors of the Clinton Foundation. Will you talk about
Tamara, that has been fact-checked by NPR and others. How accurate is that claim about the Clinton Foundation?
Well, there are some fact-check problems there in terms of Hillary Clinton's meetings. That AP article focused only on her meetings with people who were not part of government or foreign governments. And most of a Secretary of State's meetings, of course, are with government and foreign government officials, not people in the private sector. And also, Pence had claimed that the Clinton Foundation only spends 10% of its money on programs and helping people. In fact, it's more like 88%, according to charity trackers.
10% and 88%, pretty different. Let's hear Tim Kaine here talking about the Trump Foundation.
The foundation was just fined for illegally contributing foundation dollars to a political campaign of a Florida attorney general. They made an illegal contribution, and then they tried to hide it by disguising it as somebody else. And the person they donated to was somebody whose office was charged with investigating Trump University.
Domenico, how did the fact checkers think about that one?
Well, I actually think that was Tim Kaine's best moment of the debate last night. You know, the fact is that this is sort of the litigator training that Tim Kaine was able to pull out there. You know, there were a lot of moments last night where Tim Kaine tried to jump in or interrupt. This was one where he seemed to get a clean shot in talking about saying, fine, you want to talk about foundations? Let's talk about foundations. The Clinton Foundation does a lot of good charitable work, and the Trump Foundation has been in a lot of hot water lately. And that was, you could see it coming, and he was able to, I thought, to deliver on that.
He repeatedly brought up the Obama administration deal with Iran to rein in its nuclear program. Here's a sampling of that.
She worked a tough negotiation with nations around the world to eliminate the Iranian nuclear weapons program without firing a shot.
Eliminate the Iranian nuclear weapons.
Absolutely. The terrorist threat has decreased in some ways because an Iranian nuclear weapons program has been stopped without firing a shot.
You didn't stop the nuclear weapons program.
Yes, we did.
You
even the Israeli.
Tamara, is this a winning issue for the Democrats, for the Clinton campaign to talk about? I was surprised to hear that come up so many times from Kaine.
Yeah, I mean, it is something that Hillary Clinton worked on the early stages of, very early stages of. But it is something that they defend. And this is a thing where in the debate, Tim Kaine did actually defend repeatedly Hillary Clinton and her positions, where Mike Pence didn't really defend Donald Trump. And the Iran nuclear deal is a major line of attack from the Trump campaign against the Clinton campaign. And it's a those are very murky waters.
Domenico, the optics of this were a little different than what we saw in the presidential debate. And in fact, they were different than what we've even seen in past vice presidential debates, in that both candidates were sitting down. Sarah Palin actually tweeted that, why did she have to stand up when all of these men who've debated in the vice presidential debate over the last many years have been able to sit down? What did you think about that?
I don't know. Maybe Sarah Palin's tired. I don't know what I mean, what she's getting
at. It is hard
there
to stand in heels, I will say.
Yeah, I would bet. But, you know, I mean, look, the fact is, these things get negotiated beforehand, what the formats will be. We've seen a lot of the VPs sitting. We've seen some standing. You know, I thought Sarah Palin got decent reviews, even though I don't think she did that well on substance. So I don't know what she's complaining about.
And Tamara, how does the Clinton campaign, I know you've been covering the Clinton campaign for a long time now, how do they feel about Kaine's performance?
Well, John Podesta, who is the campaign chairman for the Clinton campaign, has said that he feels like Tim Kaine did a good job. And the Clinton campaign is already out with a video showing the various times that Mike Pence said, no, Donald Trump didn't say that, when Trump actually did say it. So in some ways, even though Kaine's performance was seen as maybe not the best, the Clinton campaign got what it wanted, which is a lengthy attack video using Kaine versus or Pence versus Trump.
That's NPR campaign correspondent Tamara Keith and NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Thanks to both of you.
Thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
Well, mandatory evacuations are underway in counties across Florida and South Carolina. School closings have already been announced for the week for Florida's Miami-Dade and Broward County school districts as Hurricane Matthew makes its way to U.S. shores. It's been 11 years since the last major storm struck South Florida. Some officials there worry that residents will be complacent. Florida's Governor Rick Scott today told them, be prepared to take a direct hit. Matthew packed a punch in Haiti, grazed Cuba. Let's take a look at its projected path with Jeff Huffman. He's a meteorologist for Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, when is Matthew expected to hit the East Coast?
Well, Robin, as of the midday hours, new information was coming in that Matthew appears to be re-strengthening. It took a little bit of a hit over the eastern tip of Cuba where the eye collapsed, but now the eye is very visible again. Hurricane Hunter data confirming that it is becoming stronger, and latest forecast indications are that it will be at least a major hurricane of Category 3 strength. Official forecast is for it to be a Category 4 as it approaches Florida late Thursday night and Friday. There is really nothing in Matthew's way that we see that could cause weakening prior to potential landfall.
Well, and this is why inland counties in Florida are preparing for the storm. There's mandatory evacuations. Disneyland in Orlando urging people to monitor its website. South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley is going to be evacuating 250,000 people in her state. Well, when you say it's at least a 3, potentially a 4, what does that mean? Talk about rain, tides rising.
Well, the first thing that I think of is the mentality we have as Floridians, and you mentioned it's been almost 11 years since the last major hurricane. That in itself is, I think, all of us, even those behind the scenes that prepare to inform the public, have to kind of get in the right mentality for this, and that's what Governor Scott urged this morning. He said, do it now, evacuate now. And because he was stressing that and saying the first thing to do is to know where your evacuation zone is, because that there's been 2 million new Floridians since our last major hurricane. A lot of folks may not know that they're in an evacuation zone. They may not know how to get out from where they are. And even if it's at the last minute, Robin, we have a mobile app that's designed to help you with that. It's called Florida Storms, and it has evacuation zones, routes, and open shelters, and helps you navigate out of harm's way. Once again, it's called Florida Storms, and that's key right now, knowing if you're in harm's way, and then, of course, being prepared to get out of harm's way. Because the margin for error here is just too close for comfort. Right now, it's forecast to be within 40 miles of the coast, the Space Coast, Friday morning at 8 a.m. a.m. If it's off by 40 or 50 miles, which it often is this far in advance, if it's west of the track, the conditions are going to be severely worse for inland parts of central and east central Florida. If it's east of the track by 50 miles, conditions inland will not be as bad, but conditions on the coast will still be possibly hurricane strength winds and surge. Even though the conditions may not spread as far inland, there's much more coastline that will be impacted. We're looking at possibly hurricane conditions from Miami to Jacksonville with this storm.
Given what you're talking about might happen in Florida, what about South Carolina?
If it moves west of its current track and potentially comes over land in Florida, that's better news for the Carolinas. It will undergo some weakening. If it stays just offshore, and that's the official track now, is that literally it parallels the coast.
Right.
Kind of like Floyd did. The only good news, if you call it good, is that the worst side or the most intense side of the storm would stay offshore. But as the storm is approaching, and we're going to see this in Florida tomorrow, that onshore flow and the surge and the flooding, hurricane conditions will be expected along the coast, even if the center of the storm stays offshore.
Jeff Huffman, meteorologist for WUFT in Gainesville, Florida, on Hurricane Matthew. Thank you.
My pleasure.
How much time do you spend looking at your phone or the internet? Well, if you're like most people, you check your phone at least 46 times a day. That's according to Deloitte. Another survey finds Americans spend 4.7 hours a day on their smartphones. The political commentator Andrew Sullivan was doing that and more until he realized it was breaking him. He writes about that in New York Magazine and joins us now via Skype. Andrew Sullivan, welcome back to Here and Now.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And when did you realize that being online and being distracted by your phone, which is now so common for so many people, was becoming a problem for you?
I think it crept up on me slowly and cumulatively. I noticed that my actual health was declining. I was exhausted. My time with my husband became pretty attenuated. My friendships began to atrophy. And I found it incredibly hard to unwind at the end of the day. I found myself unable to really maintain the concentration to read a real book. And when I tried to meditate, which was one way I thought of grappling with this, my mind just wouldn't take. It was so already geared towards this instant distraction culture that I couldn't even calm it down. Until at some point I realized, you know, it's a zero-sum question, this. We've deluded ourselves, at least I had deluded myself, into thinking that I could have my cake and eat it too, that I could be online but still in my regular world. Over time, I realized, you know, that's just not true. You are where your attention is. If you're involved in the web, you're not actually with your friends. You're not with your spouse. You're not with your kids. You're somewhere else.
So you said enough. And you went to a meditation retreat.
Well, I said enough and I quit everything, and which was, it shows how desperate I was, and started seriously attempting to meditate and to actually get myself offline increasingly. And I found that quite easy. I think I was so exhausted by the whole thing that it felt like a relief for a while. But nonetheless, it was still there. One still felt the urge to get that little dopamine rush, pick up your phone, until eventually I did decide to do the full detox and go to a 10-day silent meditation retreat where I would have no access to the internet. I wasn't even allowed to read a book, where I simply had to be alone with myself and the world for 10 full days and nights. But it was kind of, I thought, the real cold turkey, hard detox method that I was trying to do to remember what it used to be like before I was in this matrix.
And as you write, it was not easy. This was very emotionally difficult to disconnect in this way and have to be alone with your own thoughts.
Yeah, there's a reason we don't like it. there's a reason we, you know, even when we're waiting in line for coffee now, or even when we're in the bathroom, we want to suddenly distract ourselves. And what surprised me, it shouldn't have really, was that when you remove slowly all the distractions that you're using, you come face to face with what you're distracting yourself from. And that can obviously mean many different things for different people. We all have deep and underlying questions and anxieties in our lives. We also all have, at some level, you know, an existential dread. a sense that we hear and we die. And the modern world has conspired brilliantly to enable us to forget about that constantly, as if we're not actually mortal creatures, and that we don't have to ask ourselves, what on earth are we doing in this universe right now? Because those questions, of course, are terrifying. It's just that we've been able in modernity to really anesthetize ourselves, and the form of the anesthetic is distraction. And we have now developed technologically a mode of distraction that is now so pervasive and also permanently with you in that little phone that everybody carries around.
But is it possible to get away from that? You know, when I go on vacations, I take the Twitter and Facebook apps off my phone for the entire time. But then when I come back, you know, it doesn't take more than a day or two to put them back on and get right back into the swing of it.
Yeah, it's tough. The hard thing is, of course, using the stuff, because the internet's a wonderful, amazing thing. And of all people, I jumped into it with huge enthusiasm. And I still am hugely enthusiastic about the world of information at our fingertips. The key is some sort of balance. Is how do we stop this little dopamine hits we get anytime someone says something that you don't like or really like on Facebook, and or someone posts a new photograph or likes your new photo on Instagram? How do we wean ourselves off that so that we're not doing it in a manic, constant way? And I think it requires, real self-discipline. And we just, as a society, I think this piece was trying to say, it's time to try and master this. We love this new toy, but like a kid, all we're doing now is playing with it. You know, studies will find that your average 30-year-old is spending up to 5 hours a day on the phone.
Yeah.
The younger kids are engaging entirely with the world through a screen. And the point is that we have to rediscover how amazing it is to live life actually available to the human beings around us, to spend time, which is the most valuable commodity of all, with actual other tangible physical human beings. And also, I think, critically, to gain some silence, to actually have some quiet, just to find some moment of calm in our day. That is becoming harder and harder. And also our attention spans, of course. The value and reward we get out of reading a book, a real book, that we can lose ourselves in for a period of time without wanting to say, oh, I want to distract myself with this quick hit.
Yeah.
See who he emailed me, see what the instant message is. And then, of course, work adds a whole nother layer on it. So many of our workplaces now demand that we be on social media, demand that we be part of this world. And it follows us home. And now it follows us everywhere. Aren't you amazed? I mean, I look around me now and I see all these people with their heads down all the time.
So have you been able to not be one of those people with your heads down after the meditation retreat?
Well, yes and no. I certainly didn't write this piece saying, I fixed it. I've managed to overcome this. You all need to. That's not where I was trying to say at all. I'm still besieged by it. I think finding ways to manage it, like maybe taking a day of the week as your digital Sabbath, and saying, I'm not touching it today. Or maybe just putting some time constraints on it. Like after a certain time in the evening, no more online interaction. The number of parents that are sitting with kids around a table, and it's what Sherry Turkle, the writer, calls being alone together. Everybody's on their device. No one's actually engaging one another. And that means you're not really having a relationship with them. And if we only have relationships with abstract entities online as opposed to actual physical, awkward, flawed, but fascinating human beings, we're really making our lives much shallower than they need be. We're missing out on life. I mean, it struck me this is a way in the end of not living.
Right now, for a lot of people, the distractions that they're going to their phones for are related to this election, which is coming up
Yes. In
just 1 month. While we have you, because I know that you, too, even with all of this thinking that you've been doing about being distracted, you're very interested in this election. You've commented on it. What do you think, Andrew Sullivan? What goes through your mind just a month before this election?
Terror. I'm terrified. I really believe that one of the candidates, Donald Trump, is a unique threat to peace in the world, to to civil peace in this country and possibly to our entire liberal democratic system. I've never come across a character quite as dangerous or as menacing as this person, who's evoked the kind of passions that he's evoked, and who, if he were to win, would have nothing to restrain him, because he would win the House and the Senate and be able to pack the court, and who has expressed a desire for a kind of authoritarian government. He's a wannabe tyrant that people seem to want as a tyrant, and so much is at stake. Everybody says this about every election, and many elections have been extraordinarily important in the past. This one is really, I think, for me, life and death for this republic, and the danger of this man, his unpredictability and instability, and to put it bluntly, fascistic tendencies in terms of his support of violence, his contempt for dissent, his disdain for freedom of the press, his desire for personal retribution against his enemies. All these traits that we must know by now from history are deeply dangerous, is really closer to coming to power in this country than any time in my lifetime. And so I wanted to disengage. I really wanted to write about religion and to figure more deeply about technology. But I can't, on my iPhone, I have an actual icon that can give me the latest polling results for everything, and I'm checking it three or four times a day as a way to sort of kind of comfort myself. I mean, I think I'm not the only one waking up with panic attacks, with anxiety about this person. Now, maybe he's gotten under my skin, but I've read enough history. I know enough about how government works in this country to be deeply afraid.
That's Andrew Sullivan, contributing editor for New York Magazine. His piece, which we'll link you to at hereandnow.org, is called I Used to Be a Human Being. Andrew Sullivan, thanks as always for joining us.
You're so welcome. Love your chat.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie blinked. He'd long fought Democrats in the state to keep from raising the gas tax to fund infrastructure projects. But after Friday's fatal train crash in Hoboken, he agreed to an increase of 23 cents a gallon. New Jersey lawmakers vote later this week. This will be the first increase since 1988. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. And Maggie, so how much is expected to be raised? And we know that this money is going to go to the transportation board of the state, but what will it pay for?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are hoping that it is going to be primarily spent on making some of the numerous repairs that are needed. And it's been a long time. It's still going to be an awful shock to people, though, Robin, when it goes into implementation. I mean, they have said fixing the state's roads, bridges, and rails, importantly. It's going to open up the way they're hoping for the $2 billion a year reauthorization of the fund. That's the money that has been earmarked. But it's also going to provide a cushion. This was a trade-off, even though Christie went for it. It is going to provide a cushion to help reduce taxes in other areas. The deal would eliminate a state tax. It would phase in a lowering of the sales tax we pay on items and provide tax credits for the working poor and a tax exemption for veterans. So it's probably going to try to plug the hole in the budget for those items, too.
Right. Well, so those are the concessions that Christie got from the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, so the estate tax would be phased out completely. Some critics of this deal says it's actually going to give a tax break to the richest residents. They're really the ones who pay the estate tax when an estate mm-hmm. is passed on. While at the same time, the deal will ask for more from poorer residents, 23 cents a gallon more, and they're disproportionately impacted by a gas tax hike.
Absolutely. And there are a lot of people who are outraged by that. Absolutely no doubt about it, that estates tax is going to favor the wealthy. The counter to that is that you've got to maintain those wealthy residents. If you don't provide some sort of break, they're going to move out of your state. And in fact, I don't know if you remember a very high profile case of a hedge fund manager, David Tepper, moving to Florida, and that creating a major hit on New Jersey state finances. It threw a lot of uncertainty. Just one person moving. The top 100 filers, New Jersey says, pay over 5% of all of the taxes. So that's the argument there. You could also argue, I think, that the sales tax also favors those, while maybe not wealthy, that have more disposable income. I mean, a new outfit is a want-to-have. Filling up your car to get to your job is a necessity. But again, proponents, I think, arguing that that feeds into the broader economy and jobs. I think it really all depends, Robin, is if you believe in trickle-down economics.
Well, and obviously somebody does, because, you know, this tax has not been raised. It's the second lowest in the country behind Alaska. And we love New Jersey, especially us, you know, displaced New Yorkers. But the roads, there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. I mean, are people, in just a few seconds we have, you know, saying it's about time?
I think that's the push and pull. People don't want to see their gas tax go up, but they also, you cannot have your infrastructure crumble. And in fact, this is a debate that's happening on a national level. Remember, we're in an election. There's sometimes talk about a national tax. How do you rebuild the roads? I think if people thought the money was actually going to go to that, they might sit easier with them, especially considering that we do have some of the lowest prices in the country. However, if it just goes into the budget and you lose control over where it goes and it doesn't go to those roads and trains, let's remember what happened in Hoboken, I think people would be very upset about that. Yeah.
Well, we'll watch. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thanks as always.
Always good to be with you. Thanks.
Missouri, like many states in the U.S., is dealing with an opioid addiction epidemic. The number of heroin-related deaths alone has almost doubled since 2010 in Missouri, jumping from 183 deaths in 2010 to 338 in 2014. And a new center in the southwest corner of the state is responding to the epidemic by training former addicts to help others with their addictions. Bram Sable-Smith of KBIA in Columbia, Missouri, has our report.
43-year-old Dina Kilpatrick came to Branson, Missouri looking for a new start. She's battled drug and alcohol addiction for 30 years, since she was 13. When she moved, she was determined to stay away from all that. It was going pretty well, she says, but it was lonely.
I stopped drinking and drugs. Once you stop polluting yourself, you're just like, who am I? What am I going to do?
Then a few months ago, she relapsed and got a DUI, her fourth. She could have been locked up for 4 years, but she opted to enter the county treatment court. It's a program for nonviolent offenders to get them into recovery instead of prison. For 18 months, she's required to attend a 12-step program, meet with a counselor, a parole officer, complete community service. And she'll also get something she didn't have when she was trying to go it alone, peer support.
So you said you don't have a driver's license. Have you lost it because of a DWI, or you just don't have one?
I've lost it due to DUI, my fourth one.
Do you need housing?
Yes.
Do you need food?
Yes.
Kilpatrick is getting a needs assessment at the Peeps and Recovery Center. It's a peer support center in Reed Spring, about 20 miles from Branson. Sally Moore is doing the assessing, and like all eight of the specialists here, she's in recovery herself from drug addiction.
I don't think that any addict or alcoholic should die in their addiction. And there was somebody there to help me, so.
More than 220 people have already passed through the recovery center since it opened in January. PEEPS is like a complement to 12-step programs, but with more specific kinds of support by trained and credentialed peer specialists. Here's Patricia Sams, PEEPS' founder.
We're going to cover all of the life skill areas that people may be shaky at.
Take debt. Many people entering recovery owe money for medical bills or back taxes or court fees, and that can be overwhelming. So a peer recovery specialist might sit down with the person and say,
okay, so here's your debt, and here's your income, and then let's make a payment plan.
That may seem simple, but this support is meaningful coming from someone who shares a similar life experience. And according to Tom Hill of the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration,
the bottom line is that peers can help improve treatment outcomes.
But few states are funding these peer services, at least not through Medicaid. Back in 2007, the Federal Medicaid Agency urged states to start paying for peer support for mental health patients and for substance abuse patients. And while more than 30 states pay for mental health peers, Hill says only a handful that don't include Missouri pay for peers to help with substance abuse.
Part of that is just based on the history of mental health being Medicaid reimbursable for many, many years, whereas substance use disorders and treatment for that has not been.
As public awareness of the opioid epidemic grows, Hill expects more state agencies will pay for substance abuse peers. But for now, nonprofits like PEEPS have to find other funding to help people like Dina Kilpatrick.
You know, it was kind of a divine intervention for me, you know, be able to find this place and get a second chance, really.
So far, she's been sober since mid-May and moved in with a family member closer to the PEEPS Center to continue her recovery. For Here and Now, I'm Bram Sable-Smith.
And Bram's story was produced in collaboration with Side Effects Public Media, a regional reporting collaborative focusing on public health. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded today to three scientists, Jean-Pierre Sauvage, Sergei Fraser-Stoddart, and Bernard L. Farinha, for their work in the growing field of nanoengineering. Specifically, it was for the design and synthesis of molecular machines, the building blocks of tiny robots that could one day revolutionize medicine, computing, and energy storage. We're joined now by Donna Nelson, president of the American Chemical Society and professor of organic chemistry at the University of Oklahoma in Norman. Welcome to you, and I know it's an exciting time for you as you've awaited the news of this year's Nobel Prize.
Yes, it absolutely is. You know, each year the chemical community has talks among itself. Well, what do you think the award will go to and who do you think will win it? And there's always so much excitement surrounding this. And it's really thrilling to get to hear the announcement.
So tell us what molecular machines are and why they're so important.
Well, those are going to be very tiny molecules that have a functionality, a specific functionality designed inside to make them do one intended operation or another when light is shined upon them, for example, or when they're heated. I think it's a really exciting area, for a number of reasons. They offer a lot of promise for the future, but also what better way to capture the fascination of the scientists of tomorrow than with these micro machines. I think it's absolutely fabulous.
And they're not like little machines with a motor. It's not like a tiny little car or something like that.
Correct.
Right. So,
correct.
So what are they exactly?
Well, each machine is a molecule. And so a molecule, of course, is a collection of atoms. And so they're designed and synthesized, and that in itself is a challenge, and then also proving that they have synthesized what they intended to synthesize is another challenge, and then building in the functionality so that they will move upon exposure to light or heat is another challenge, and then proving that the functionality actually works is another challenge. So it's a very challenging area. And these people have succeeded at every level. So it's fabulous what they've done.
It makes me think of, and I know that you're involved in some Hollywood depictions of chemistry, but it makes me think of the movie Innerspace, when they send a little tiny machine inside a person. Now, one of the winners has said that maybe one day these tiny little robots could be injected into the bloodstream to seek out cancer cells. What else could they do?
Well, I think that they have already been injected into the bloodstream to deliver some some medicines or pharmaceuticals. I think that most of the promise is going to come in the future. And, you know, each year, of course, the Nobel Prize greatly benefits the recipients, but it benefits all of us scientists in that it focuses the attention of the world on science. So in that way, it's a gift to all of us. We all benefit from it.
We've been talking this week about the different Nobel Prizes that have been awarded, and I noticed that this is the second one this week, in addition to the prize in medicine, that involves things that are tiny. What do you think that says? That that the great research that's going on involves these tiny things you can't even see?
Yes. Well, nanomaterials has been a hot series of research for quite a while. We're constantly trying to focus on smaller and smaller quantities of molecules, smaller molecules, everything, because we're trying to reduce the amount of material that's required in the things we need to build. We're trying to design the molecules so that they'll go places they wouldn't go before. We're trying constantly to generate less and less waste, you know, mm-hmm. so we're trying to make our chemistry green. I think that this award really hits on all of those areas in addition to the area that they specified. So it's fabulous in so many ways. It's really exciting.
What's the next thing that needs to be discovered? What's the next question we need to answer when it comes to these tiny molecular machines?
Well, I think that, you know, we've got to explore the functionality. This area is really going to blossom, and I would expect the functionalities and the applications of these molecules in particular to blossom in the near future faster than it would have done without the prize being given in this area.
And by the way, I have just been told that even though I said that it's not as if this would be a tiny little machine with a motor, such a thing does actually exist right now. There's a tiny car, I guess, that can go inside.
Yes. That's true, but I don't know that it has a motor. Uh-huh. I mean, it has been shown to roll down a sheet of graphene, so it has been shown to have the functionality of a little car. But, you know, a motor, I don't know about that.
Okay. That's Donna Nelson, president of the American Chemical Society and a professor of organic chemistry at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, joining us to talk about the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Donna, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
And now to the news that Yahoo secretly scanned all of its users' incoming emails at the demand of the U.S. government. We know that many phone and internet companies have handed over other kinds of bulk customer data under government directive, but this is the first known case of an internet company searching all arriving emails in real time. Now, Reuters reports that Yahoo built a custom program last year to bulk scan the incoming emails and look for a specific set of characters requested by U.S. intelligence officials. It's unclear what exactly the government asked Yahoo to look for, or if other companies were asked to do and did the same thing. Joseph Menn broke the story for Reuters. He joins us by Skype from San Francisco. Joseph, tell us a little bit more about what Yahoo was doing and how long it was doing it.
Well, a year and a few months ago, Yahoo security staff found a program on the Yahoo's email servers, and they thought that they'd been hacked. So they sort of scrambled the planes, and they started investigating, trying to figure out what the program did, why it was there, and how long it had been there. And it hadn't been there very long, within weeks. But they went to the email engineers and said, hey, you guys need to know about this. We just ripped it off. We just took it out, and we're trying to figure out what it does. And the email engineers said, you might want to check with the legal department on that.
Right. And with Yahoo chief executive Marissa Mayer, who, according to your reporting, it was her decision to obey the directive from the intelligence officers, and she's the one who went to the email people and actually asked them to set this up?
That's right. I mean, I don't think that she gave that command. There's mm-hmm. probably a hierarchy there where she told people to tell them to do that. But yeah, Marissa Mayer okayed the program. She decided to keep the security staff out of the loop and not fight it in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court in Washington.
Well, and of course, the accounts of what happened inside Yahoo come from some former Yahoo employees and others who were aware of the situation. Is this legal to search email in real time, as incoming email?
I don't think that's clear. And we may not know for a while because, well, we'll see what the fallout is, but they didn't challenge it, and if they had, it would have been behind closed doors. So these things have a habit of coming out eventually, we've learned over the past few years. The argument that it is legal would be that something similar happens with the big phone carriers, where they're allowed to search for a specific topic or word rather than a certain person's account. But there are all these safeguards in place to make sure that Americans' data isn't looked at unnecessarily and so on and so forth. There's minimization. So the argument would be that this could be true for the internet companies as well. We just haven't seen it before. The other argument is that it's a Fourth Amendment issue. It's unreasonable search and seizure. That's one issue. Another issue is that Yahoo actually had to build a special program to do this. If that reminds you of anything, it might be when the FBI asked Apple to design a special new program to unlock an iPhone belonging to the San Bernardino shooter. And Apple refused, and things were sort of going in their favor when the FBI found another way into the phone. So the stance is in contrast to that.
Well, and do we have any more idea what U.S. officials were looking for? You talked about a strand of characters that they were asking Yahoo to ask this software to look for. Do we know what they were?
No, I sure wish I did. It's a really interesting question. It could be a lot of things. It could be, if it's an imminent threat situation, there's a terrorist with a bomb, and they could be looking for code words that's going from somebody, you know, a terrorist group overseas, theoretically, to somebody in the United States. Because it's just a string of characters, it could be a piece of malware. It could be a specific piece of malware that if anybody opens and clicks on it, they're going to get infected because there's no defense against it. And they might be urgently trying to find who's spreading that and stop it without knowing what email account it's going to come from.
Yeah.
Could be something else entirely.
But it's not that Yahoo employees are sitting there reading your emails. It's software. So what is Yahoo saying about what it's doing? And what can people concerned about even software going through their emails do to protect themselves?
Right. So on the first point, Yahoo, before the story ran, would only say that it obeys the laws of the United States. This morning, Yahoo said that the story was misleading without specifying how, and it said that it does not currently have a system in place that scans emails, incoming emails. Mm-hmm. So that leaves, my sources had told me that the security staff had ripped out the program before they figured out that it was authorized, and maybe it never went back in. That's one good theory. On the privacy issue, there are other email providers. I guess I should note that Google scans people's email to sell you ads based on the words there. Again, it's not a person, it's a program. But if they have that ability, then if the federal government follows legal process, they should be able to access that information as well.
Yeah.
It's just that there, some companies might argue more forcefully against a government demand. And it's kind of a mystery which ones are arguing the hardest.
Yeah. That's Joseph Menn, technology project reporter for Reuters. You can read his exclusive story on Yahoo secretly scanning all of its users' incoming emails at the request of U.S. intelligence officials at hereandnow.org. Joseph, thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.